I wanted to move on to our final part of the program today, which is about Honus Wagner. And we are fortunate to have two authors of a very well-received Honus Wagner biography, which most of you in this room probably own. Dennis and Jean Burke de Valeria are attending their first Sabre convention in more than 20 years. Now, Wagner's Hall of Fame plaque says that without equivocation, he was the greatest shortstop in baseball history. His Hall of Fame online biography cites John McGraw's comment that Wagner was, quote, the nearest thing to a perfect player, no matter where you played him. Sam Crawford called Wagner the finest player he ever saw, which is no small praise for someone who played alongside Cobb and against Ruth. Wagner was a natural. His Sabre Bioproject piece by Jan Finkel begins with a quote by Wagner, where he says, "There isn't much to being a ball player if you're a ball player." Now, Dennis and Jean de Valeria co-authored this biography, and Wagner, who at least along with Roberto Clemente are at least the two greatest players in Pirates history. And there aren't many Wagner biographies, but theirs has stood the test of time. And I'd like to welcome Dennis and Jean Burke de Valeria.
On?
Yep.
Is this one on? Okay, great.
Wow, thank you so much for inviting us. We're honored. It has been more than 20 years, and we were very active in the Sabre organization for a long time, but it has been a while, so it's good to see a few old friends and a few familiar faces, and we appreciate it. You're the gentleman who won the award for this year's Dead Ball book. Our trek was a lot different. Our odyssey was a lot different. We'll start just briefly explaining how it was different. It began when we moved to Pittsburgh in 1991. We're big history fans, history buffs, love baseball, and we like reading about American history and about baseball players through well-written biographies. So when we got here, we wanted to learn more about Honus Wagner, who, with all due respect to Roberto Clemente, we feel is the greatest pirate. So we were surprised when we got here to find so little about the man. And we were curious. We started to do a little research, delved into some things. And what we did find, much of it was apocryphal. And part of that is Honus has himself to blame. He was a tall storyteller. He would tell ridiculous tales. And some of that made it into print as fact. And just not a lot written. So then we started to think, why wasn't there more? And there were some reasons. The dead ball era. It was a long time ago. It does not capture the imagination of the casual fan. He was not a controversial figure. He was not a womanizer. He never shot anybody. He never ate 100 hot dogs in a sitting. So he didn't have that type of reputation. So compare that, and the other thing was he lived, born, raised, lived, played his career, and died in the Pittsburgh area, not in Boston or New York. So all of those things contributed, we believe, to the fact that there hadn't been a lot about him. He also shunned the spotlight during and after his career. He was a rather shy gentleman. So we thought, well, we'll dig a little deeper.
So this was the early 1990s, as Dennis said, and we didn't have access to the internet. We didn't have access to newspapers.com. There was no ancestry.com. So we traveled to every community where Wagner played professional ball. We read microfilm of period newspapers and sporting publications from the local libraries and history societies. We also interviewed historians, baseball and societal historians, and we interviewed people who knew Wagner. We went to the Hall of Fame, and they were building a new library when we were there, so we had to sit at a coffee table, and they brought files out to us. And I remember hunching over this coffee table for hours, flipping through information and trying to jot down notes. Anyway, we started accumulating information, and initially we thought maybe we'd write an article about Wagner for a Saber publication, but it quickly got out of control. The turning point came at the Saber convention in San Diego in 94. We needed some information from some prominent researchers, and we weren't going to say we were writing a biography of Hannes Wagner and then not follow through. So it was 3 years from the beginning until we had a book.
Over the years, we've done a number of presentations about Wagner to all different types of organizations, and I think this is probably a group that we do not have to explain what a good ball player he was. I think, you know, that's probably established. You know, he's clearly on the list of greats, what Bill James referred to as kind of the pantheon of the Hall of Fame. During Wagner's heyday, Hugh Fullerton, the sports writer, referred to him as the closest approach to a baseball machine ever constructed. And John McGraw, who played and managed against Wagner for 20 years, often in the midst of very heated pennant races, wrote about Wagner in his autobiography, My 30 Years in Baseball. He said of Wagner, "Wagner will go down in baseball history as the greatest of all time. It is almost impossible to determine whether his highest point of superiority was in his fielding, in his batting, or in his base running. He was the type of ball player who could beat you with his bat, his glove, his head, his arm, or his legs." During his time, baseball truly was the national pastime. Again, dead ball era, I don't think I need to tell you that, but it was truly the national pastime, and he cut quite a figure in the game and in the nation and certainly in this area. In fact, at one point, Pittsburgh's own Andrew Carnegie expressed some jealousy. Here's Carnegie in the philanthropic era of his lifetime, giving libraries to local communities. And he was a little peeved that Wagner was getting as much publicity as he was in the local area for simply being a ball player.
Wagner was big for his day and bow-legged. You wouldn't think to look at him that he'd be fast, but he was. He was fast, and he was aggressive on the bases. He stole 6 bases in the 1909 World Series. He stole 20 or more bases in 18 consecutive seasons. And he had 20... Oh, I'm sorry. And he ended his career with more than 700 steals. It was his base-running ability that induced a sports writer to label him the Flying Dutchman. It was, in the field, he wasn't pretty, but he was effective. One sports writer said he was as graceful as a steamroller. He had this habit of judging a base runner's speed, the batter's speed, to first base and getting the ball there just in the nick of time, and that drove his manager, Fred Clark, crazy. You all know that the gloves of those days were tiny and rigid, and he said later in life that he used to cut the palm of his glove out and stitch around the opening himself to get a better feel for the ball. And we assumed that was another one of his tall tales until we found the glove. So we included a picture of that in our book. Though he's best remembered as a shortstop, Wagner didn't play short until his 5th big league season. Over his 21-year career, he played every position except catcher. He even pitched twice. Many felt he would have been great anywhere. In fact, teammate Tommy Leach said about Wagner and Lawrence Ritter's The Glory of Their Time that he was the greatest shortstop ever, the greatest everything ever.
That being said, he's best known for his hitting, and that's what 8 batting titles will do for you. He moved around in the field, as Gene said. He also moved around in the batting order over the course of his career, but for the most part, he was a cleanup hitter and considered a thumper at the plate and a run producer. He spent the first 2.5 seasons of his big league career in Louisville, when Louisville was a member of the National League, and like any good hitter, loved his bats, doted on them, tried different bats, and parlayed his friendship with John F. Hilrichen's son out of Louisville into being the first player to have his signature branded into a Louisville Slugger. He and others had had block letters, their names branded into a bat, but he was the first to have a very flowery J. Hans Wagner branded into it. He used many different models, sizes, weights, lengths of bats over the course of his career, would change later in his career, was a little different, and he would even change bats during a ball game depending on how he felt, who was on the mound, whether it was a fastball pitcher, a curveball pitcher, et cetera. He sometimes, but not always, used the split hand grip that you're so familiar with. That was part of his arsenal, but he did not use that constantly. He earned a well-deserved reputation as a bad ball hitter, and there were some different pieces of advice that were given to young pitchers on how to approach Wagner when they first saw him at the plate. And one was to simply walk him, but that didn't always work because he was such a bad ball hitter. And another was to simply throw the ball and pray. Now, there was no MVP award during the heyday of Wagner's career, but an argument could be made that he would have won six in the first decade of the last century. The 1995 convention, the Sabre National Convention that was held here in Pittsburgh, and it was a time that we were very active, our friend Neil Traven wrote an article for that convention publication that analyzed the best seasons by position for Pirates. And the best season by a shortstop in Pirate history was by Wagner. In fact, the top eight shortstop seasons for a Pirate were by Wagner, which is something to say because, I mean, we had Dick Groat here with an MVP season. We had Hall of Famer Archie Vaughn here. The best Archie Vaughn could do was the ninth best Pirate season as a shortstop. Wagner's manager, Fred Clark, called him the best ball player who ever stood in shoes. Hall of Fame umpire Bill Clem called Wagner as great a man as he was a ball player. He was the best I ever saw, and I saw them all over the last 60 years. And one final quote, John McGraw said, records do not tell the story of Wagner, they merely help. It was his wonderful personality, his sixth baseball sense, his actions on the field. These things cannot be expressed in figures. Hans Wagner was also blessed with that peculiar thing, for a better name, we call personality. There was something magnetic about him. He was just as popular in one city as another. Even in the smaller leagues, his name was a byword. He was a great drawing card. Whether the home team won or lost, the fans wanted to see Wagner. He left an indelible mark on the game, we feel, and he certainly left an indelible mark on baseball history in Pittsburgh. So thank you again for having us, and we will answer some questions that you would like. No questions? All right. Yes. Can you give an example of something you claimed that wasn't true, but you kind of think it was, and then you found out otherwise?
Oh. Well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
During the 1909 World Series, allegedly Cobb, Wagner was at first, allegedly Cobb yelled down to first.
He was at short.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Wagner was at short. Cobb was at first. Go ahead.
Okay. It's a very famous story of during the 1909 World Series that Cobb allegedly yelled down at Wagner when Cobb was on first that I'm coming down on the next pitch. And there are many, many different ways the story is told. I'm coming down on the next pitch, crowd head, or I'm coming down on the next pitch, you old timer, whatever, because Cobb at that point was 23 and Wagner was 35. So Cobb allegedly came down on the next pitch, and depending on the story, either Wagner decapitated him, knocked a tooth out, any number of things. But the point of the story was the same. Wagner wasn't going to put up with that crap from anybody, let alone a 23-year-old kid. So the story's not true, but Wagner, if you bought him a beer, would make the story last for, several hours, if necessary. So there were other examples, but it's that kind of thing. And then the tall stories were so outrageous that none of them were true, and we all know that. The home run, or he's at shortstop, and there's a ground ball to him, but a rabbit comes across the field, grabs the ball, And he threw the rabbit and the ball to first and got him by a hair. You know,
the stories were excruciating. And he told one after another. I think he was uncomfortable as a public speaker. And so he got a few stories like that. And he was often called to speak at various groups, dinners, and things like that. And he was shy, so he would rely on stories like that.
In the overlap with the award winner of this year, during World War I, just after his career is, you know, it's just being over, he was asked to give a number of talks to support the war effort and collection activities and that kind of thing. And like so many celebrities of the day, he had to rehearse a four-minute little pat speech that he would give to people. And some of the stories that he would include were ridiculous. But he could memorize them, give them, and feel comfortable, make people laugh, and that was it. Yeah, Craig.
Well, you know, basketball was kind of a primitive sport at the time, and they actually did play in a cage. And he liked to play over the winter because it was a way of keeping in shape. He had a tendency to put on weight, and it was a good way to get some exercise. Of course, they didn't work out in those days like they do today. So his Fred Clark and Barney Dreyfus went to see him play one time, and wouldn't you know, that was the time that he got thrown to the ground or thrown to the floor right on his throwing arm, and they were just beside themselves and were going to insist that he stop playing, but it meant so much to him that they didn't.
Wagner would say that they played in a cage, and you actually had to get thrown through the cage to have a foul called. So, you know, it was a primitive sport. We'd hardly recognize the game to watch it today. You know, two-handed set shots, not much dribbling. The ball had stitches on it, but he was a super athlete. You know, he bowled. He was very good at any type of athletic endeavor. But other extracurricular activities that he got involved with were he loved automobiles. He was for his time a wealthy man, and so he loved automobiles. He was early adopter, and
even had a little dealership.
Yeah.
Briefly. What?
Garage and the dealership, a Regal,
the
Regal dealership. And like so many business ventures that he had, it was not a huge success. But he got involved in a number of different things that wealthy athletes would have done at the time.
Jack? Well, actually, it was kind of the reverse. Al was older than Hannes. And Al was a very good ball player. He started playing professionally before Hannes did. And then got Hannes involved in professional ball. But pretty quickly, Hannes bypassed Al. And, Al spent a lot of time in spring training with the Pirates. But, you know, he was going to be forever known as Hannes' brother.
And Al had a brief major league career and a long minor league career, much of it in upstate New York. I don't remember which particular city, but he was a good ball player, but never a great ball player, and always was kind of in Hannes' shadow, even though he was the older brother. Yes, sir.
Well, he bought a lot of property in Carnegie. And so he was a landlord. He got involved in various businesses. He got involved in a sporting goods store, actually a couple sporting goods stores, one with Pi Trainer that didn't last long. The other one just closed.
Within the last decade or so here locally, but he was no longer, his family was long out of the picture. In fact, during the Depression, they ran into some. He was fine until the Depression. He was probably considered well-to-do, had a big home in a nice neighborhood of his hometown of Carnegie, right outside Pittsburgh. And then during the Depression, he got clobbered. He lost his business. And he retired in 1917. This would have been the Depression years. He's fine up until then. And then Barney Dreyfus, the long time owner of the Pirates, had passed, and his son-in-law brought Honus back as a coach. And when Honus joined the club as a coach in 1933, he really was a coach. Now, the coaching staffs then were different. You didn't have a bench coach, a hitting coach, an infield coach, and on and on and on. There were only a couple of guys who accompanied the team, but he was active as a coach. And then as time rolled on, he got less and less active and was more of a PR figure, like almost a coach emeritus of the team up until very near the end. And he was the first Pirate to have his number retired as his coach's number. He had no number as a player.